Hello, and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Have you gotten all that sand out of the various orifices, Sean?
No, there's a little bit left in some places you can help me with later. Oh. And I'm super as always.
Leave it in. It'll make a pearl. Sean and I are back from a much-needed break, a vacation. Where have we been, Sean?
We have been in Corfu, we've been in Paxos, and the little island of Antipaxos.
Antipaxos, which is a bit like anti-Paxos.
Yes, but it's the anti-Paxos.
It doesn't mean it's against Paxos, it means it's before Paxos.
Mm-hmm, like an antechamber.
You know, I think it's interesting that we've been taking budget airlines to island getaways. We've been passing through borders and airports and customs.
We've been holding our breath as we go through the blue channel. The red channel is goods to declare. The blue channel is European Union, and the green channel is nothing to declare.
You know, I always actually make a big decision about which one I'm going to go through, but I feel like nobody looks or pays attention.
Yeah, having just read Jackie Brown, which is the book and film we're talking about today, I'm keeping my eye on customs guards from now on, and air hostesses.
Air hostesses? What, are you living like 1963?
Oh, excuse me, air stewardesses.
I believe the choices are air hostesses, which, I don't know, that just sounds like very antiquated. Stewardess, which was like, when I was growing up, the era of coffee, tea, or me. Or now the politically correct, gender-neutral term, flight attendant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Uh-huh.
Or flight crew, even, which is kind of the more butch version.
No way.
No, you're not into flight crew.
No.
What did you... So we flew, full disclosure, we flew on EasyJet for our holiday. What were your thoughts about their outfits?
I like the female outfit. It's a simple black dress with an orange belt, okay? Mm-hmm. Not too much into the guy's one. The guy's one is a bit like, I'm here on your doorstep wanting to know your opinion about, like, waste disposal.
Well, you know, if Tim Gunn were there, he'd just take those flight attendants aside and say, make it work.
Yeah, he would.
So we've got flight attendants on the brain, we've been going through customs, and we've been sitting on the beach in Antipaxos, and we've been reading, haven't we, Sean? What have we been reading?
Let's not forget the cavity search you gave me on holiday. Okay.
God, the things I found up there.
I found another rubber glove.
What have you and Richard Gere been doing since our last episode? But you read this book faster than any of the books on our reading list, I would say. You devoured it.
Well, only when I was reading it. When I wasn't reading the book, it didn't get read. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Wait, do you want to tell people what the book is?
Yeah, Jackie Brown.
It's not actually Jackie Brown.
Excuse me, you're right. It's called Rum Punch.
By?
Elmore Leonard.
Rum Punch by Elmore Leonard. Yeah, a kind of book that neither you nor I would habitually read, even on the beach. I mean, let it be known, I'm prone to bring big, massive literary tomes with me. The last time I was on Greece, I think I was reading Middlemarch. This time I was finishing off Elena Ferrante.
You are so Brian, you know that.
Hey, whatever, you know, I gotta be me. But when you go into an airport bookshop, it's striking that you're not finding the Middlemarches, you're not finding the Prousts and the Mills on the Flosses. Instead, you're finding, I don't know, Lee Child crime thrillers and Dan Brown and David Baldacci and all these people that I've literally never read a page.
Yeah, it's like the worst place to get a quality book on holiday is in the airport bookshop.
But clearly, I mean, these mass market trade paperbacks, like, people love them. People read them on holidays and other times. I don't read them, but also you don't read them.
Reading a book on a beach, gotta be honest, Brian, is not something I do. Yeah. I usually read The New Yorker on the beach.
That's true. So I guess in this sense, you were doing the standard thing, which was to pick up a pulpy, enjoyable crime thriller and to read it on the beach.
But this is a very particular kind of crime novel, which is, like, I know it's a Quentin Tarantino film we're doing, but is it pulpy? Can I use that word? I mean, it is a high-octane, nicely drawn-out series of sketchy characters with one, like, greedy plot device at the center, which is to get a whole load of cash.
It's a heist story.
I really enjoyed the story. I really enjoyed the characters. Like, I would close the book because I was enjoying it so often to kind of take in what was happening. And when there was extended periods where I was really enjoying the story, I'd find that I was reading it too quickly, and then before you know it, it was finished, really.
So, I think we talked a lot in the last episode about how we didn't like the writing style of Judith Rossner, author of Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which I literally just, like, I don't know who was copy editing that book, but, like, when you repeat the same adjective three times in one paragraph, I mean, just, like...
Just fire someone.
Get out a fucking thesaurus, Judith, or, like, you know, skip some sentences. I mean, please. But I think you're absolutely right that, like, Elmore Leonard, this is the only novel of his that I've ever read. It's this propulsive novel of people double-crossing one another and a crime caper and trying to, you know, get away with the dough and running guns, and there's murders and all that stuff. Yep.
Everyone's playing each other.
But it's written in this fabulous way that, like, if you just take a half step back from the enjoyment of what you're reading, you're like, what brilliantly crafted sentences, what little amazing insights, what little telling details about characters and their idiosyncrasies.
What an intricate, complicated plot that somehow you're able to follow.
Yeah, I would say I could follow it while I was reading if you tried to get me to explain it now, because I read it a few weeks before you did. I'm not sure that I totally could recall it. Do you want to explain, like, who are the main characters? So it's actually not someone named Jackie Brown in the book.
We should say straight off, first of all, that she's called Jackie Burke, and she is not Pam Grier. She is a white blonde lady. So that's the big difference, we should say, first of all. But the plot of it is essentially this. Jackie Burke is a flight attendant working for Island Air. She has been a bit of a chancer all her life, and she has this deal with this crook named Ordell. He has money in the Bahamas, and she transports up to $10,000 of his cash every so often.
Why 10,000?
Because, as I read on the sign leaving the airport yesterday, if you have any more than 10,000 euro, dollar, pounds in cash, you have to immediately declare it. If you're 1 pound over, you're in trouble. And in this one particular sting, Jackie gets a manila envelope full of $50,000 and also some cocaine, just to make it more complicated. The guys who take her in, these two cops who are there not to arrest her, but to find Ordell, and she makes an agreement both with them and her crime boss to transport $500,000 of cash across, and little do they know that she is going to double-cross all of them to take the money for herself.
Yeah, basically.
That's basically the plot.
Yeah, she's told Ordell that she's going to pretend to work with the cops, but actually they're going to arrange this thing where the bags get switched and he can get the money. Mm-hmm. But then actually the real thing that's going on is she's playing both of them off each other and trying to get away with an even bigger amount of money, which she's going to use to get away and kind of change her life. She's basically fed up with the dead end that she's in, working in a rinky-dink air stewardess job.
Yeah. And she's been married three times. Yeah. She's lived a life, and now she wants it.
She kind of has no prospects.
Yeah.
So that's a fun thing to read. Like, how are they going to do all these double crosses? Who's going to get away with whom? There's a whole host of other fun low-life characters and cons and malls and women, and there's fucking and there's fun and there's satire. I would also say, though, like, at the heart of it, I think the thing that I connect with is this idea of middle-aged people who are kind of realizing that, like, the things they've been doing all their lives, the mistakes they've made, the kind of roads they didn't take, right, all of that, is kind of reached its dead end. And they're kind of saying, is this our one last chance to kind of get out of this and get a fresh start? And that is, I think, embodied in the novel by the relationship that Jackie has with this bail bondsman named Max Cherry.
Great name.
Why?
Well, Max means, like, ultimate, maximum, you know? Cherry is a delicious, yet highly, you know, sexually ambiguous fruit.
Why is it sexually ambiguous? It
just is.
I think what's nice about that name is that, like, Cherry has this kind of sweetness to it, but Max Cherry is this guy, he's sort of both tough and not tough at the same time.
Well, he's a bail bondsman, so he's not an upstanding person. Like, they're
it's
all
a legal profession.
It is, but there's shadiness in all forms.
He knows his way around a gun, and he can rough up people if he needs to get the bond back, but he is also, he has values, he is kind of separated from his wife. He's a schlub in a lot of ways, right? Max Cherry in the novel is this kind of guy that we see the whole story kind of through his eyes. And just like Jackie, he's kind of also reached this point where he should get out of this marriage, he should get out of this life. So in addition to being this fun crime story, it's also this kind of touching story about two middle-aged to older people who are finding one another kind of as their second chance, mm-hmm. or third chance, or fourth chance, or however many chances they've had in their lives. And I think that's why I respond to it as having this very rounded, kind of three-dimensional, melancholy sort of aspect at the heart of all the crime.
You learn just as much as you need to know about each character. You know exactly what these people look like, what they sound like, how they behave, how they think. So we have the movie edition of the book that has the pictures of the cast on it. But even if I didn't have those, I have these very vivid images of who these people are. I think we should quickly go through who the other people are. We pointed out Max Cherry, who's played by Robert Foster, and Jackie, who I am expecting to be the most different, is played by Pam Grier. Samuel L. Jackson plays the main crook, Ordell. Robert De Niro, would you say his character of Lewis is like a bit of a change from his typical type in the sense that he's kind of useless?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Michael Keaton, in one of his last roles before he takes a break, is the cop that Jackie's working with. And Bridget Fonda plays Melanie, who I actually think is my favorite character in the book, who is this like... They describe her as gone to seed blonde woman with huge tits and a big can, and as her most distinctive form, she's this like dope smoking, lazy sun worshiper.
Yeah, you love her because she's just like a woman who seems to have no profession other than like sitting in deck chairs, like absorbing the sun and like reading movie magazines.
It's like, that is what I want to be.
Kind of sleeping with gangsters.
I'm going to start dressing for the job that I want to have. She's permanently...
Denim cut-off shorts.
Yeah, and a string
top.
Yeah. And like matted sun-kissed hair. But the thing they say about her is they're always like, she's probably 30, but she looks a lot older.
Hashtag goals, babe. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So they're basically the characters.
So neither of us have read Elmore Leonard. We would give this book 2 big thumbs up to anyone, right? Read this book. A lot of Elmore Leonard's novels have been adapted very successfully into movies. He wrote the books that were the basis for the films Get Shorty, Out of Sight, which is a great Steven Soderbergh film, and he himself is on record as saying that when Quentin Tarantino adapted his novel Rum Punch into Jackie Brown, he thought not only was it the best adaptation of any of his books, mm-hmm. he also thought it was the best screenplay he'd ever read.
Oh, wow.
Now, I can remember, so I've seen the movie of Jackie Brown on VHS soon after the movie came out. But I remember the anticipation of this movie. I think it's 1997 the film comes out. Tarantino had exploded onto the scene in the early 90s, right? Reservoir Dogs, a cult hit. Pulp Fiction, a massive success critically and commercially. I think it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Mm-hmm. Certainly he did. He got some prizes at Cannes.
And at the Oscars too, didn't
he? He won screenplay at the Oscars. It kind of got lots of nominations. Do you know how every year at the Oscars there's like the cool film that doesn't win? So like Pulp Fiction was the cool film and Forrest Gump was the movie that ultimately won. Yeah. But I think everyone was wondering, what is Tarantino going to do next? If you went to indie films in the mid-90s, which was the time when I was going to high school, suddenly everyone was writing stories and dialogue that were so clearly influenced by Tarantino, with like low-life characters and lots of verbal, you know, references and wordplay and all this kind of stuff, and also violence, right? All that stuff. But he waited before coming out with whatever his follow-up was going to be, and I can remember reading articles anticipating this movie where it was saying he took a really long time writing the screenplay, he took a really long time deciding what the follow-up was going to be. You know, I think a lot of people who were expecting Pulp Fiction 2 kind of got that and didn't get that with Jackie Brown. It's those qualities of the roundedness and the maturity and the psychological sophistication. It's those things that made me say, I really like this movie. I can relate to this movie. I can relate to these characters in a way that, while I like the normal style of Tarantino, I don't really ever find it to be real.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Jackie Brown, I haven't seen it since it came out, it always felt to me like the characters' choices and their emotions really matter. For me, that's what's always made it my favorite Tarantino movie.
Well, I think I'm excited to see this because it is the only film, as far as I'm aware, that Tarantino based upon work that wasn't his. Tarantino's films always feel like they exist in a world that is Tarantino creation, which is totally fine. But by taking a world that already exists with characters that have already existed before by somebody else, it gives him a way to refocus. So I gotta say to you, I'm really excited to watch this film.
As opposed to all his typical kind of fanboy movie references that ultimately sometimes seem sort of superficial and lightweight.
Which is not to say that this isn't obviously a huge fanboy film by the fact that he put Pam Grier in the lead role.
Yeah, okay, so talk to me about that. So it's really hard to read this edition of the novel, which it has to be said on the cover, it doesn't say Rum Punch. It actually says
Jackie Brown,
and it has the movie poster. And I'm sure actually these days most people who buy this book get this edition and not whatever the original one looked like. So it's hard when you're reading it not to picture Pam Grier, but in the novel, how would you say this character of Jackie Burke is described?
Okay, so she's a woman who's probably in her late 40s. She smokes a lot. She's got blonde hair, but she's in quite good shape. She's sexy in a very particular kind of way.
So who would you cast if Tarantino had kept it that way as Jackie Burke?
You helped me picture a more world-weary early 90s Kathleen Turner.
The kind of Kathleen Turner of V.I. Warshawski, perhaps?
What?
You don't know what V.I. Warshawski is?
No.
That was Kathleen Turner's ill-fated attempt to create a female private eye franchise. I know, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. The kind of tough broad.
Yeah, so that's who I was picturing, but it is not to say who Tarantino could cast in it. Well, because the thing is, I think it's unfair that by 93 or 94, she was playing Beverly Sutphin, you know what I mean? She was serial mom. I think Kathleen Turner, before the arthritis kicks in and everything, would have been pretty good as Jackie Brown with the right makeup and the right hair.
So what about this choice to turn her from Jackie Burke into Jackie Brown? Now, it should be said, other than Shaft, I have never seen any blaxploitation films. I've certainly never seen Foxy Brown or Coffee. So like Pam Grier, I don't know anything about her. She's not an icon to me the way I think she is for some people, and certainly she seems to be for Tarantino.
Mm.
What is that making you expect?
Well, the thing about Pam Grier is that she has a kind of face that says, don't fuck with me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I would say she probably doesn't have the same kind of enthralling blankness that the Jackie Burke of the book has.
In some ways, the book is really not told from Jackie's perspective. I would say the book is more told from Max's perspective as this mysterious woman comes into his life.
What I think a huge difference about this will be is the fact that, yeah, it's going to be racially different as well. Pam Grier is tough. She comes preloaded, as it were, with this own history of blaxploitation films. So I'm very curious to see how she relates to all the other characters, especially perhaps Ordell, who is the other main black character in the film, who is definitely, regardless of any race, he's not a nice person.
There's something about casting a black woman as his antagonist in this that shifts it. Great. Well, before we turn to the movie, should we give people a little flavor of what Elmore Leonard gave Tarantino to work with?
I'd love to.
All right, well, normally either you or I would read the extract, but why don't we read Jackie and Max alternating the voices? Do you want to be Jackie or do you want to be Max?
I don't know how to identify with a male character, Brian, so it'll have to be Jackie.
Well, I can identify with schlubbiness any day.
Jackie was concentrating on the cigarette, bringing the ash to a point. She said, "You know how many miles I've flown?" and looked up at him.
Max shook his head. "How many?"
"About 7 million. Jetway to jetway. I've been waiting on people for almost 20 years. You know what I make now, starting over? 16,000 with retirement benefits you can stick in your ear. How do you feel about getting old?"
"You're not old. You look great."
"I'm asking how you feel. Does it bother you?"
"It's not something I think about. I look in the mirror, I'm the same person I was 30 years ago. I see a photograph of myself, that's different. But who's taking my picture?"
She said, "It's different with guys. Women get older at an earlier age."
He said, "I guess they worry about it more. Some women, all they have is their looks. They lose that. But you've got way more than looks."
"I have? What?"
"You want to argue about getting old? What's the point?"
I feel like I'm always starting over, Jackie said, and before I know it, I won't have any options left. I'll be stuck with whatever I can get. She said, I told you last night I've been married twice. Actually, I've had three husbands, but two of them I think of as the same guy. At age 20, and then a much older version. Their names are even the same, so I say I've been married twice.
It was quiet in the kitchen.
She said, that's my history. I've logged 7 million miles, married two drunks and a junkie.
As a crime story, this book doesn't need to take the time to just focus on that sense of regret and melancholy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's this lovely vein that runs through the whole story and kind of tells us a lot about who these people are in those little vignettes. And you can kind of see at least some of that dialogue being replaced in the screenplay. I wonder to what extent it will be shifted and changed by the Tarantino style and also by the casting.
Well, I wonder how my line readings will compare to Pam Grier's.
Do you think the casting of the other characters makes sense? Is it exciting? It's a very kind of starry, all-stars cast, especially for people in the 90s.
The character of Melanie, who's played by Bridget Fonda, is too young and pretty. Because in my version, she's much more kind of haggard, bigger tits, bigger ass, much sloppier. She seems to be a hot blonde girl. You know, remains
to be seen.
But maybe
that's interesting to have her be a hot blonde girl, especially if you're going to make your female heroine more of an older, world-weary black woman.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just saying. Well, it is actually interesting in the book that, like, they are these two women who are both circling around the orbit of Ordell, the gunrunner. And in some ways, Jackie maybe sees that she could end up like Melanie if she got deeper into the crime and deeper into letting men control her. And Jackie, I think, ultimately is trying to be her own woman and be independent. And this is kind of the story about how she does that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah?
I really hope that Bridget Fonda has, like, really sharp tan lines. You know those tan lines on the tits? You know, where it's like you got a bikini outline.
And darling, I generally don't wear my bikini top when I go to the beach.
Yes, well, you have tan lines of a different kind. Brian, I can say probably that this is the best book we've read in the series.
Yeah?
This was just by far the most enjoyable thing I've read.
Wow, great. Yeah. That's high praise.
Yeah. And I'm really, really looking forward to a film of a quality to match the work.
Okay, we shall see.
Brian, I'm going to make some rum punch. You want some? I've also got a gun and a gram of cocaine. Let's watch a movie.
So sorry about this. You know, I was afraid to ask to borrow it. Because I was afraid you would say no. I mean, you'd have to. Would you like some coffee?
If you're having some?
I am. Come on in. Why don't you make yourself at home? You know, just, you know, have a seat.
You get a chance to use it?
Well, I felt a lot safer having it. Oh, the milk went bad while I was in jail.
Black's fine.
Cool.
Would you care to hang on to it for a while? It wouldn't be legal, but if it makes you feel better, I guess.
Well, thanks. I got one now.
You went out this morning and bought a gun?
What? I didn't hear you.
You went out this morning and bought a gun?
Well, let's say I got one now, okay?
Somebody loan it to you?
Yeah. All right. We're on. Might be a little black, man. Would you like to hear some music?
I gave my heart and soul to you, girl. Didn't I do it, baby? Didn't I do it, baby?
Thank you for flying with us today. The flight crew will be coming through the aisle with our refreshments.
Ladies and gentlemen, today I have to apologize in advance. We're all out of TWA coffee, but we still have plenty of TWA tea. an old one, but a good one.
A good one that Elmore Leonard included in the novel, but it was sadly not in Quentin Tarantino's screenplay. I guess that was probably my only regret about this movie. Sean.
We have to just confess how much we loved Jackie Brown.
This movie, if anyone listening to this episode has not seen Jackie Brown, see Jackie Brown. If anyone like me saw it years ago and vaguely remembers it being good, go back and watch it, because this is the kind of movie that will remind you everything about how good mainstream, entertaining, but really brilliantly crafted movies can be. And I say this as someone who is not a Quentin Tarantino fan or devotee in any stretch of the imagination.
Well, you know, you could say that this is the Tarantino film for people who don't like Tarantino films.
But it also is a movie that has his strengths in it. I'm just gonna, like, start riffing on how much I love this movie. Like, how does it begin, Sean?
It begins with Jackie on one of those motorized walkways, standing perfectly still. It's almost as if the set is gliding by her rather than her gliding. You know what I mean? She's in her uniform, her airline uniform. What is the airline in this one?
It's called Cabo Airline because they've moved it from Miami to LA. So she's not flying to the Bahamas. They're flying to a resort in Mexico. It's, what's it called? Like Cabo San Luco or something. Sorry, yes, to our Mexican list. Sorry, Valentina.
Cabo con fuego.
Valentina's Mexican, right? I didn't just engage in a bit of Trumpian, like...
I think she might be Mexican.
I hope so. La Virgen de Guadalupe, do not smite me. Okay, anyway, carry on.
Well, we follow her for a good, say, I think 5 minutes, really. It's a jolly shot of her walking through the airport, past all these various things.
Going through security. Yeah. I think this is the genius. Like, it's slick and it's playing with the music, all that kind of retro Tarantino slickness. But he's also setting us up for all the thematic things that are going to come to be, which is crossing through borders and security and detecting criminality. Because we're going to constantly have these shots of Jackie walking through things. Like, it's going to culminate in that amazing heist scene. So it's so enjoyable on a cinematic level, but it's also training us for the story that's going to come. That's why I call this masterful.
Yeah.
She kind of rushes because she's a bit late to get on the flight attendant's desk and her colleague is there. She hustles in, she kind of turns and she puts on her best flight attendant smile and she says, "Welcome aboard." And we cut away from Jackie for quite an extended period of time and we go to Ordell's pad, which is now on the beach in LA, not in Miami. And there's Samuel Jackson as Ordell and Bridget Fonda as Melanie, Bobby De Niro as Lewis.
Yeah, I would say that this is quite a faithful adaptation, but Tarantino's screenplay took some liberties with the order in which things are told. He trimmed out a few unnecessary bits, but which are still very enjoyable in the book. There's a whole kind of neo-Nazi subplot that's trimmed out.
The neo-Nazi thing is that they're trying to get a whole bunch of weapons from this kind of right-wing militia and then sell them, right? So we get a lot more detail of Ordell's actual criminal enterprise in the book. Also a lot more detail of the police investigation, and we kind of follow the policemen and their involvement in that. There are kind of plot holes that those plots help to fill. Like, it's never really explained why Lewis is working with Ordell at all. In the film, like, Robert De Niro is just hanging around as his, like, old friend who's just gotten out of jail, but he never actually employs him until the very end.
It's funny. This is probably one of the films I've ever seen where Robert De Niro is really very supporting, if you know what I mean. Robert De Niro is amazing. He's amazing in the worst pieces of shit there is. I feel he's a bit underused in places. Like, there's a couple of scenes in the book. There's a greater sense of his ineptitude and his criminality.
I think what's interesting is, like, this movie, am I right, kind of is before De Niro moved into, like, the comic versions of, like, isn't this, like before, like, Meet the Parents and, like, Analyze That and Dirty Grandpa and all that stuff that he does now? So I think it's funny because he's playing comedy in this. He's kind of, like, dopey. He's smoking a lot of weed with Bridget Fonda's Melanie. And I actually think Tarantino knows what he's doing by casting De Niro because he's been this kind of likable goofball. But because he has to snap on Melanie toward the end, which we can talk about, the fact that it's De Niro, you kind of just are like, oh yeah, of course he's a psycho. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he was Max Cady in Cape Fear. Is that his name?
Yep.
I was about to say Max Cherry. We'll get to Max Cherry. But can I say, I remember watching this movie the first time. I remember thinking, like, the movie's called Jackie Brown. I thought it was going to be about this woman that I just saw riding through the airport.
You were like, I want my money back.
Well, I did.
This is false advertising.
I didn't pay for the VHS, darling, because as you know, I got 52 free weeks of movie rentals from Video to Go in Milton, Massachusetts from winning their Oscar contest. So I'm sure I got this movie for free.
Yes.
Yes. This is my greatest accomplishment in life ever.
What about being a Rhodes Scholar?
No, far better that I got 52 free weeks of movies. Anyway, I remember watching this and being like, this feels like more like a normal Quentin Tarantino movie. Here's Samuel L. Jackson using the N-word, like...
Every half word.
He's putting
like,
it
not
on,
even
like,
every second word.
It's like, you know, HP sauce. He's just layering everything on it.
Your American listeners won't know what that means. It's like putting catsup on something.
My American listeners don't know what catsup is.
It's like putting Thousand Island dressing on things.
Can I say HP sauce, just a brief moment? The label of it has the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah, that's where it came from.
I know. It's the sauce from the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah, it's a bit like someone put Russian dressing on something.
Well, you know, Russian dressing in this White House would be indeed entirely
oh,
appropriate.
Oh, darling.
That's what we call a burn.
It is. Yeah.
Anyway, okay, sorry. The N-word. Let's get back to the N-word. So, obviously, Samuel L. Jackson is peppering it throughout every dialogue he has. He and Lewis are hanging around looking at videos of guns. They're talking like criminal tough guys. Melanie, Bridget Fonda is smoking dope. And you're kind of like, where is all this leading? There's scenes between Samuel L. Jackson and Chris Tucker. What? Okay, pause. You loved Chris Tucker.
I love Chris Tucker in anything.
For real?
Yes.
Is that because of The Fifth Element?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you notice this is one of two films in which Chris Tucker has acted with Robert De Niro? This film.
Yeah.
And Silver Linings Playbook, King's Playbook.
Oh my God, Chris Tucker. Yeah. That was an aspect of Silver Linings Playbook. Him and Jackie Weaver, I just was like, why are they even in this movie?
I love Chris Tucker. Chris
Tucker. No, I like him, but I'm just saying, Silver Linings Playbook was structurally really weird. Do you remember Julia Stiles was in it? There were a lot of people in it that you're like, why are they in this movie? They've not been given enough to do. Okay, but so Chris Tucker, who does he play in this?
He plays Beaumont Livingston, who was this lad for hire for Odell. And Odell bonds him out of prison. Then when he finds out that Beaumont has been blabbing, he blows him away.
Yeah, and all that stuff, like, those scenes are really good. Like, the long banter between Samuel L. Jackson and Chris Tucker, and he takes him out in the car and he shoots him. And then he brings Robert De Niro and looks at him in the trunk. But they feel to me like your standard Quentin Tarantino scene.
There are things that obviously drew Tarantino to this work, and, like, you know, that is part of the deal.
But I guess what I'm saying is, I'm there as the kind of lover of middle-aged women and emotional life, and I'm waiting, where is this going to come in this movie? And it comes in a big way, right? So as soon as Jackie gets involved in the action, it's not to say that I don't think those other scenes are well done, but every single scene in this movie with Pam Grier, whether it's Pam Grier with Robert Forster, Pam Grier with Samuel L. Jackson, Pam Grier with the cops, is genius.
Yeah. And you know what? We were mistaken. She got the Golden Globe nomination, she got a SAG nomination, but Pam Grier did not get an Oscar nomination.
And it's pure racism.
It is. It's one of those things where the Academy chose 5 white women over 1 amazing performance by a black actress, and it's just not right.
The year that this movie came out was not like the most heavy hitter in terms of acting. I mean, I will defend Helen Hunt. I'm not one of those people who thinks that she's like the worst best actress win of all time.
No, I don't think that.
I don't know the full list of people who beat Pam Grier, but it's definitely includes Judi Dench and Mrs. Brown, Helena Bonham Carter in The Wings of the Dove, and Helen Hunt.
Maybe it is also genre bias as well.
But those three are all good in those movies, and I'm a fan of The Wings of the Dove in particular. Like,
of course you are.
No, but Helena Bonham Carter has almost never been better than that. Those are all good. But, like, you can just imagine Tarantino on Oscar nominations morning being like, what is this bullshit? Because those all represent the kind of stuffy movies or middlebrow movies that he has no interest in. What Pam Grier is doing in this movie, it transcends, like, genre. I know people think, oh, Uma Thurman was overlooked for Kill Bill, and that's an arguable case to make as well.
I'm shaking my head.
Okay, but, you know, people love her in that.
I used to love her too.
But what I'm saying is, Jackie Brown is the most complex and richly crafted female character Pam Grier...
In Tarantino's entire filmography.
We've looked at a lot of movies from the 90s, have we not?
We have.
With female heroines. Go back and look at our previous episodes if you haven't seen them. Pam Grier gives out and out one of the best central female leading roles of any of the 90s movies that we have seen. Is that...
Oh, I'm not disputing that for a second.
What else did you like about this movie before we, like, riff on Pam Grier at the center? Were there other things that you really enjoyed?
I just love the entire cape. I've been wrapped up in it. I was completely hooked, line and sinker.
You mean that whole third act section in the mall where they're doing the exchange of bags?
When you think about heist films or, you know, films about blackmail and double crossing, they're always so high octane. And so much of this takes place in a mall. Mm. And I love that.
It's a bit...
Because it feels just as tense.
It's a bit like Double Indemnity, where Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck keep meeting in that banal suburban grocery store and having their conversations. And this is similar. Like, they're in this mall, in this food court. They're trading kind of bags from quite bougie shops. And things like finding your car in the parking lot become, like, crucial and actually end up in a lot of violence. That's where Robert De Niro ends up shooting Bridget Fonda, because she's, like, taunting him because they can't find the car.
And in another piece of brilliant framing, he shoots Melanie while she's off screen. For me, Melanie being shot off screen is much more powerful because it's so cavalier. It's kind of like superfluous. This, the money's important. Let's get the money out of here. The heist becomes more important.
It emphasizes the expendability.
Yeah.
This movie has real threat, right? And actually, there's quite a few instances where Tarantino averts us from actually head-on looking at violence. So Chris Tucker is shot in the long shot. Melanie, as you say, is shot off camera.
Which I find the Chris Tucker shooting just as unpleasant as if it were in front of my face.
Well, I can remember that scene in Pulp Fiction where they accidentally shoot that kid in the backseat. Yeah. And it is just like... disgusting and hyper-violent. I think there is a maturity to this movie. He's not doing it in a way that feels over-the-top and exploitative and, like, purely aesthetic, which gives the movie just a grittier sense. And the way that they film that replay of the handoff of the bag, we basically watched the heist three times, I think from three different people's perspective.
For the second time, I was like, did they not do it? Why are they going back?
Why are they going back into the shop? And I was like... Babe, you've smoked too much weed. There was a line that you love that Melody had.
Oh my God.
Where Ordell says to her when she's smoking that big bong, that shit is gonna rob you of your ambition.
And she's like, not if your ambition is to get high and watch TV. But there's also one other Melanie line, which I love. Ordell comes home to find her, like, you know, stoned. He goes like, shit girl, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she's like, oh, is it that late?
Yeah, squad goals.
Yeah,
Melanie.
I love Melanie. I want to be Melanie.
Okay, so yeah, that's all the stuff that is surrounding what I would say is the heart of this movie, yeah? Which is this fascinating, building, slowly simmering dynamic between this 44-year-old flight attendant, Jackie, and this even older bail bondsman played by Robert Forster, who is both brilliant and sympathetic and strikingly handsome for an older man. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, I love handsome. Older men. You know this.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, what do you think about the character of Jackie, her relationship to all these other men in her life? Do you agree with me that it's as good as it gets?
By turning Jackie from a white woman to a black woman, there is a wholly new and unique element to the film that book just does not have. The way Jackie deals with the men in the film is quite funny, because she's tough and hard, but she doesn't need to show it very often. She really modulates what version of Jackie she gives to people depending on who she's speaking to, while at the same time being authentic.
At first, when she's dealing with the cops and stuff, she's quite internalized. She has this face where her lips kind of curl to the side. She's kind of looking sly, right? She's very beautifully coiffed at first in her flight attendant look. But then, of course, she gets put in jail and she comes out and her hair is not the way she wants it to be. She's a very proud woman. But also, because she's essentially a working class 44-year-old black woman, that line gets repeated a lot. They're like, you're a 44-year-old black woman, you're a 44-year-old black woman. The cops say that to her. Ordell says that to her. You just get this sense that she's someone who's had to put up with a lot of shit.
Mm.
And she's internalized everything. So she's very muted. And then suddenly, there are moments where it almost feels like this badass heroine, like, comes out of her. So there's an incredible scene. She's been let out of prison, having been caught by the cops. And Ordell comes over to her apartment, presumably to kill her, right? Because he's already killed Chris Tucker.
And he's got his, like, gloves on, strangulation gloves.
Yeah, so he's got his... Well, I think they're also gloves so that there's no fingerprints.
Uh-huh.
Right?
He could strangle her very softly.
Strangle me softly with his song. Strangle me softly.
Brian, if you sing anymore, we'll have to pay some rights.
You used that joke before. Anyway, so he's come over to her house. Do you remember the choreography of the scene? And this is, I think, again, where we have to praise not just Tarantino, but the late Sally Menke, his editor, the DP of this film, whose name I didn't write down, but just like the roaming camera. So they're playing this delicate game where Jackie wants to keep the lights on in the house, and Ordell keeps trying to turn them off. And Jackie is, like, chit-chatting with him kind of very subdued fashion, right? They're just kind of exchanging pleasantries. He comes up to her, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, this voice emerges from Pam Grier in the dark.
Is that what I think it is?
What do you think it is?
I think it's a gun pressed up against my dick.
Well, you thought right. Now take your hands from around my throat, nigga.
What the hell's wrong with you, Jackie?
Shut the fuck up and don't you move. Oh, what is this? What the fuck is
Hey, now that ain't got nothing to do with you. I carry that all the time. You've been talking to them police too much.
Oh, the police didn't try and strangle my ass.
Oh, come on, girl. You know I was just playing with you.
Well, I ain't playing with you. I'm gonna unload both of these motherfuckers if you don't do what I tell you to do. You understand what I'm saying?
Jackie, stop acting crazy.
Do you understand what the fuck I'm saying?
Yeah, woman, damn.
Now sit your ass down on that sofa.
See?
From that moment onward, it's like she finds within herself her badass Foxy Brown archetype, right? That I think, like, Tarantino was genius by putting her in here, because for people who know her blaxploitation heritage, we sense that this average woman who's a flight attendant has this badass street smart quality. Yeah. But it's almost as if she's playing that role when she needs to, and she's being what you call, like, her authentic, vulnerable self at other times.
Question. Do you think we're supposed to believe that Jackie already knows how to use a gun?
At one point, when the cops are asking her, you know, why is it that you've been smuggling money for Ordell all this time? And she says, he needs me because he can't trust anyone else because I'm not a crook. She's not a criminal, but she's been wrapped up in this world, right? So she's kind of this marginal figure who's trying to make it on the straight and narrow, more or less. I think what makes her desperation to carry through with this heist is all the more intensified by her being, as they say, a 44-year-old black woman who only after 19 years in the airline industry is making $16,000 plus benefits. Yeah. And she's basically saying, if I lose my job, that's what I fear even more than Ordell, the dead-end life that it would come otherwise.
This Jackie is kind of like hustling to survive, you know what I mean? She's like, she's a grafter.
There's just something about putting a black woman into that predicament that just intensifies it because of the history of race in America.
Yeah, of course.
Do you want to say something about her scenes with Robert Forster as Max Cherry and their romance? Because that's also a bit different from the book, isn't it?
You know, this is kind of an interesting difference. In the book, they sleep together. They develop a relationship like midway through it, okay?
And Max also has scenes with his ex-wife, which are quite good scenes.
They're
in the book.
They're good scenes, yeah.
Nowhere to be seen in this. It's not even a reference to his ex-wife.
Do you know who I would have cast as his ex-wife were she in the film? Who's that one from Flirting with Disaster?
Taya Leone.
Yeah, I would have
She's far too young.
No, I would have cast Taya Leone.
She's literally young enough to be his daughter.
We could just put some makeup on her.
I would have cast Shelley Duvall.
Really?
Yeah. Otherwise known as the Countess Gemini. Sorry, she has to be older.
No, but what about Mercedes Rule?
Okay, Mercedes Rule maybe.
Yeah, but anyway, what are we talking about?
Max Cherry and Jackie.
Well, don't you think that in movies, the crowd-pleasing aspects are usually played up? Wouldn't it make more sense that in the book he doesn't get with Jackie, and in the film he does get with Jackie and they kind of develop a thing? Whereas in this, he's kind of, like you said, kept as this kind of puppy dog who follows her around the entire time.
I mean, it's so cute. He goes over... Mm. So, I mean, he meets her... bailing her out of jail.
There's this slow shot where she walks dejectedly from the prison, and we see a kind of a reaction shot of Max, like, seeing this vision in front of him.
Well, yeah, a vision, but also a woman who seems like she needs his help, because he's bailed her out, she looks a mess, he takes her in the car, and every conversation that they have early on is, like, testing the limits. It's like, I'm gonna drive you home, would you want to join me for a drink? And she's like, can we go somewhere where there's low lighting? Because I don't want anybody to see me looking like I just came out of prison.
And that's something I love about Jackie, this character, is that she's not a one-note tough old bird. She is vulnerable, you know, worn down. She feels ashamed and stupid when life really makes a fool of her.
And she's vain about her appearance. Like, she has all these, like, lovely little grace notes. But then when he returns to her house the second time during the day, we know that she's just confronted Ordell and shown her, like, badass credentials and stolen his gun. But Max just sees her as this, like, woman that he's attracted to, and he's, like, glancing around her room, and it's this, like, simple apartment decorated with all these kind of Afrocentric artworks, and, like, she puts on some, like, classic 70s funk and soul music, and he doesn't know what the artists are, and she's just making him coffee and being quite normal, and he's like, now where did you get that other gun? And she just doesn't even want to get into it.
Yeah, because we, as the audience, are watching her in the kitchen, like, making coffee, but she's only partially visible because the kitchen cabinet is covering her. She's not in the center of the frame. She is doing to us, the audience, what she's doing to him. Maybe we'll just not ask her any more questions. Maybe we'll just leave her alone.
And this is the genius of the filmmaking, because in the same way that those roving shots create the tension when she's confronting Ordell, these kind of off-center shots are kind of showing us that Jackie is this elusive character until she and Max eventually get to know each other and form this bond, which is all about the heist. It's so cute. Robert Forster is so cute in this movie. She's kind of jazzed him up to, like, say, come on, take this adventure with me. Like, you need a shake up in your life as well. And then he's, like, going out and buying cassette tapes of the music she likes to listen to. Like, he's basically, like, a teenage boy who's, like, has a crush.
I love it.
And it's so cute. And I know what you're saying about you would think that the movie would be more explicit than the book, but actually, the movie sustains itself so much on this, like, slow burn of their relationship, where you're just like, when are they gonna kiss? When are they gonna acknowledge that they really love each other? And that's what makes it so sweet, and that's why you care about them.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you think that Max Cherry is the stand-in for Quentin Tarantino?
Apparently, when she came in to meet with him for Jackie Brown, he, in his office, had two framed posters of her movies from the 70s. And he was like, look, I was gonna take those posters down because I thought you would think that I was sucking up to you, but actually, I've had these posters forever because I am such a fanboy of yours. And so I think, in a way, yeah, like, Tarantino is watching Pam Grier through a fanboy's, you know, cinematic eyes. What do you think about her scenes with Samuel L. Jackson?
They feel more traditional Tarantino.
It's nice seeing that dichotomy, isn't it? Like, she even dresses differently.
Yeah, she wears, I presume it's her own Kangol hat that she wears when she sees Ordell. It's just so funny.
Because he wears
one. I just find it so kind of coincidental. She is mirroring him. And you may notice that they had this scene in the food court, and her clothes are noticeably different. So Jackie's clothes could be a whole section we talk about, because Jackie wears, obviously, her flight attendant uniform. She wears dresses. She wears jeans, and she also...
She puts on that kind of streetwear when she's meeting with Ordell. And then in the climactic heist scene, a key point of it is that she goes into this quite fancy shop. That's where the trade-off with Melanie with the bags of money happens. And it all involves her
buying
in the dressing room buying this gorgeous...
Yeah. It's,
suit.
It's one of those suits where it's like, it's feminine, but it's also, like, hard.
Like, if Pam Grier had been nominated for an Oscar, you would have wanted her to show up in that kind of a badass, feminine, masculine suit. Like, a bit
like
Jodie Foster when she won for Silence of the Lambs. Well, you weren't into that.
No, that was like, didn't she wear like a tutu with it or something?
A tutu?
Suit jacket and a tutu.
No, that is, okay. I suspect Jodie Foster has never worn a tutu in her fucking life. Can we please
stop? No, you just swear,
can
Brian.
Can we stop the fake news? I just want everyone to point out that Sean McGovern just claimed that Jodie Foster wore a tutu to the Oscars when she won for Silence of the Lambs. Everybody Google it. She wore an Armani suit without a shirt with décolletage showing.
No, I remember the décolletage.
There was
sure.
No tutu involved.
Hang on a second.
And now we will pause the podcast while Sean does some Googling.
Do you really need to look this up?
Well, I mean, it would be good for
it
the podcast.
Not correct.
Jodie Foster, Oscars, Silence. No, there's no tutu. It's just a long jacket. She's wearing pants.
Okay, what about the first one she gets?
Yeah, she's wearing like a prom dress.
Okay, fine. Okay, she's so wearing a suit.
We're going to come back. Sean, what did Jodie Foster wear to the Oscars?
I think you should keep all that in, by the way. The second time around, she wore an Armani suit with an AIDS ribbon.
AIDS ribbon.
And the first time around, she wore some kind of like Midwestern prom getup.
Yeah, so basically it was Jodie going from being the teenage girl of John Hinckley's dreams to being the like, fuck you, John Hinckley, I'm gonna rip out your balls.
I think it might have been Celine Dion at the 1988 Eurovision Song Contest who wore a suit jacket with a tutu.
It's amazing. Whenever I think of Pam Grier in the same breath, I think of Jodie Foster, and then I think of Celine Dion. I can never keep those three straight. Yes.
Yes!
Okay, pause. Ladies and gentlemen, Sean McGovern confused Jodie Foster with Celine Dion. Too much weed, darling. Too much weed. Can we return to our podcaster, Jackie Brown?
Okay.
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, you should write some sort of essay or post about the sartorial choices of Jackie Brown. I think that would be amazing.
Okay.
In order of wrapping up, because we've been talking about this relationship between Max and Jackie, and actually a really big change from the book is how it ends, right? So, you know, the actual climax of the crime plot happens in much the same way that it does in the book. Melanie gets shot in the car park or parking lot. Ordell shoots Lewis, and then Ordell comes to get Jackie and Max, and there's a kind of a double cross. There's that great scene where Jackie is waiting for the final confrontation, right? In the dark. And what's she doing?
She's practicing with the gun. Like, she's practicing pulling it out of the drawer and pointing it.
And what's so great about that is, again, we've seen that badass quality that she has, but here she is, like, alone. And again, we see that while she's good at that aggressive performance sometimes, it's clearly a performance. It's something she needs to rehearse. It doesn't come 100% naturally to her. But basically, the cops are there. They've called them in advance. Michael Keaton, as the cop, shoots Ordell. Jackie and Max have kept the fact from the cops that they've actually funneled away the majority of the money, and Jackie's going to go off to Europe with the money. And in the book, how does it play out?
Well, how the relationship ends in the book, they sleep together, they are romantic with each other. And at the end of the book, from my view of it, Jackie and Max drive off into the sunset together.
And in the movie, as you said, we've been waiting so long for them to come together, and
they kiss, though. They
yeah,
kiss.
But he says that he's not going to go with her. He's not going to go with her. She's made this offer. Why do you think Max in the movie doesn't go with her?
I just think it's, you know, Max is a bail bondsman. He's not a hero.
Well, he's put himself out.
He has, but he's put himself out enough. You know what I mean?
Can I say, no, I'm actually going to challenge you on that. Max puts himself in more jeopardy than anyone in the movie because he goes to Ordell's house to get Ordell to come back. Are you listening
to
me?
Yeah, I'm Christmas listening to
you.
Okay,
then you're looking away to the wall. I'm going to do that again.
No, keep that in.
No.
Please.
When Jackie's there to confront Ordell, the cops are all waiting. It's a bit like that Murder, She Wrote thing where, you know, Jessica Fletcher confronts the criminal and the criminal's about to kill Jessica. And then she's like, I'm sure you'd like to tell that to Officer Schmidt, who's waiting behind this potted plant. And then they're like, we should have listened to Mrs. Fletcher in the first place.
It's funny, don't you think it's almost anticlimactic? They do kill Ordell by Jackie saying that he's pulled the gun when he hasn't, you know?
But exactly, this is what makes the scene genius, because Jackie and Max have conspired to basically lie to the cops and say that Ordell has pulled the gun because they don't want Ordell revealing that there was more money that they've run off with. So in a sense, they do a very immoral thing in a way by getting Ordell to die. Of course, we don't care because Ordell is such a villain. I mean, he's so bad. And the way that Samuel L. Jackson plays him, he's one of the great all-time villains.
Oh, so evil.
What, that makes the ending so much more morally complicated.
Yeah, technically a man who's unarmed and since he's not holding a gun is shot dead.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So what I'm saying is Max has made this huge sacrifice of his reputation. He's gotten involved in a crime which might result him losing his bail bondsman job. He's actually put his life on the line to confront him with Ordell. She's now offering him to go off to Europe with him, and he doesn't take it.
He gets $50,000.
What's that about? Is he just a kind of hesitant character, or does he just think that maybe nothing could be as exciting as what they've been through so far? What's the story?
I don't know. I think it's Max. It's all Max.
They kiss, and he gets a phone call for a new bail bondsman job, interrupting their close-up kiss. And he says to the person on the phone, can I call you back in about half an hour?
Like, he could have said...
Half an hour?
He could have said, sorry, Max Cherry, bail bonds is out of business.
What I'm saying is, what's he going to do in that half an hour? Is he going to go in the... Because he walks in the back room, it goes out of focus. Is he either going to masturbate because he just finally kissed the woman he's in love with, or is he going to cry?
Yeah.
Or, like, read some Rilke, you know? I don't know what he's going to do.
He's going to read some Hildegard. Is that a thing?
Who's Hildegard?
So what's that Danish one you like?
Kierkegaard.
Gets it. He's going to read some Kierkegaard.
That's a movie I'd watch. So it actually doesn't end with Max. It ends with Jackie driving off. She's unattached. She's not got a man. She's got her money. She's off to a new future. And Tarantino is yet again staring his camera at this incredible woman as she listens to the same song that played at the beginning and she drives off to a new life.
Very true.
Thoughts about the movie in general?
Just a terrific piece of filmmaking. How many Oscar nominations did it get?
One.
Just one? For Robert Forster?
Robert Forster. Yeah, it's that same Do the Right Thing where...
Who was the white guy in Do the Right Thing and got the Oscar nomination?
Who do you think?
John Goodman.
John Goodman is not in Do the Right Thing.
Okay, who?
Danny Aiello, better known as the father from the Papa Don't Preach video.
Oh no, that's so bad.
He's good in Do the Right Thing, but I mean, literally everyone in Do the Right Thing should have been nominated for an Oscar.
What's her name should have got? Rosie Perez should have been nominated.
Anyway.
I could play that role.
You could play Rosie Perez in Do the Right Thing. What happens when I rub an ice cube around you on a hot summer day?
My nipples get bigger.
Fight the powers that be. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can't tell, we undeniably love Jackie Brown. Read the book, watch the movie. I just don't think Quentin Tarantino has... I know he's a good filmmaker, but this movie is so much more consistently adult and mature and interesting than the direction he's gone in.
It was his third film as a director. It's kind of like... I am someone to take serious.
Yeah, but then he's not. Yeah, followed it up with but what more I mean is emotional seriousness.
It's kind of like, okay, I did something serious. You took me serious. Now I'm going to be Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, I know, but I just want him to make another Jackie Brown. Well, sorry, Quentin.
I hate The Hateful Eight. I think I just there's no point to that film.
And yet, Quentin made a masterpiece. Everyone should watch.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, so speaking of last chances and dead ends and riding off into the sunset, it's nearly here. We've got one more bridge to cross. It's a covered bridge. It's in Iowa. And it's with Marvelous Meryl Streep. What am I talking about?
I think you're talking about the book The Bridges of Madison County.
I am. It is the end of our literary adaptations chick lit series.
Oh, thank Christ.
I wonder who came up with this idea in the first place. Who was it who assigned us an 11 or 12 book reading list?
It was me, Brian. It was me.
It was.
I regret everything.
Well, luckily, this last book, The Bridges of Madison County, is very short. I have already read it in the space of less than 24 hours. I'm sure you're going to enjoy reading it. But I'm sure...
Are you?
No, I'm not sure of that at all. The best-selling pulpy romance set in the Midwest. Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep. Believe us, ladies and gentlemen, the movie is good, even if the book may be middle class, middle brow, twaddle.
Don't spoil it for me, babe. Do you know what, Brian? It's been an amazing journey, this project that you and I have done.
And, as Cloris Leachman would say,
It's not over yet.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this, you should follow us. You should comment on us. You should review us. Subscribe to the podcast. Go on to iTunes or whatever Apple is calling it now. Go on there and leave us a rating or a review. Give us those 5 stars that we gave to Jackie Brown. You can subscribe to the podcast there, and it'll come right into your feed every time a new episode arrives.
Yeah, you don't even have to listen to it. Just subscribe.
Subscribe, and rate us. You can also find us on Twitter, can't you, Sean?
Yes, you can find us at Broad Appeal Pod, or individually, I'm at Sean McGovern X, and you are at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
Choose Sean if you want thirsty selfies. Choose Brian if you want Proustian references.
I've done one thirsty selfie, I think, possibly ever.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. We're about to fly off to Cabo with
$500,000
and a year's supply of cosmetics from Anastasia Beverly Hills. Bye.
Bye.
I was the third brother of 5, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, yet nothing crossed my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go.